So we will go ahead and begin. All right. So can everyone recap everything from me from last week real quick? Constantinople was started, Council of Nicaea, Arianism denied, all of these things. Yeah, so a lot of our focus this evening has to do with kind of the ramifications of the Council of Nicaea and what happened in the Roman Empire as a result of all of this. There's a lot of reactions. I said at the beginning of this, kind of at the introduction, that there's so much that changed in the early 300s with the way that the church saw themselves, that how it goes forward is greatly defined by all that goes on here. You have the abandonment of Rome, which leads to the bishopric in Rome starts having ideas about itself in maintaining Romanism. And so the primacy of the Roman bishop starts welling up at the complete denial of the rest of the entire church that says, I'm sorry, you're not all that in a bag of chips. And you really don't get anything that we kind of ended on this last time. You really don't get anything that looks like a papacy or anything like that until about the year 600 with Gregory the Great. Before that, no matter how many times people try to revise history, the reality is there is no such thing as a papacy in Rome. There are bishops of Rome. We have accountings of them, unreliable accounts of them, but unfortunately. But the reality is that the church is trying to address and figure out what authority is and what structure belongs where and who's in charge. Can we use politicians like Constantine, or can we not? Is it a good thing to use Constantine or not? And here's the thing, is power is a fickle thing. If you use it for good, and you set a precedent for using such power, next month, next year, next decade, that power may be held by somebody who does not have the same good intentions, and instead uses it for evil. Yes. Oh, absolutely. We're going to see it tonight in Constantine's own reign. We're going to watch an entire regional synod headed by Constantine support Arianism. So it's a remarkable switch of things when the church ascribes itself, even tangentially, to a leader that is ultimately a king, an emperor. When the church latches onto that, now we're going to be drugged through whatever mud that leader's going to go through. And the reality is that the church in the West specifically never learns this lesson. We keep doing it, and we will always forever do it. And so the reality is that after this, it kind of sets this expectation that when there's a good leader in place, we all support everything, everything's great. And then when there's a bad leader, we all get confused. And then we start talking about monasteries and, you know, hiding away in the mountains or something. But the reality is the early church reacted the same way, and the interactions with the world and the interactions with the current state of both theology, the life of the church, the practices in the church, as well as how do we solve the issue of heresies. As we go on in history, you're going to see when the Western church, specifically the church in Rome, takes upon itself the ability to use the sword as judge and executioner, there's a real quick way to deal with heresy. If you have somebody that's preaching something that'll damn someone's soul for eternity, then dispatching their temporal existence is actually a net positive, isn't it? To kill a heretic. What's that? Well, if we give them time, they could preach it to somebody else and lead people astray. So this is one of those things that we don't really think about it in times of simplicity, but in times of crisis, one of the things that happens is if a church finds itself in a power vacuum holding the sword, now what are we supposed to do? We poke the heretics. What's that? Let go of the sword, but then somebody else picks it up and we all die.
We're all going to die anyway.
So this is an interesting thing. And so we're going to pick up the Council of Nicaea and the immediate aftermath and a lot of the effects of this. And then we're going to talk about a couple of really important people. One tonight that we're going to talk about in great length is Eusebius of Caesarea. He is enormously important for the concept of what the church thinks of itself. He is the first church historian, and so he does sit kind of high in our minds as those who study church history. There are other ones that are less popular, but I would argue more capable and less in love with Constantine. That helps. You know, if you're reading a publication that is largely in support of an emperor, and it's kind of hard to judge the balance, shall you say, of the story that's coming about. Because the reality is that Eusebius of Caesarea not only lived at the time of Nicaea, but was actually present for this. When he's writing a history of all these things, he's writing the history. In fact, the vast majority of what we've been talking about for three centuries, the greater half of the information comes solely through Eusebius and his history of the church. That includes martyrs, that includes emperors, that, you know, all sorts of things. The other half is just primary sources and things like this, but he's one of the major writers of history up to the year 300. And the thing is he kind of writes with this push towards, we finally achieved the goal of the church. And you can understand for a reason. I mean, Eusebius himself was born in the late 200s. He saw with firsthand account, the persecutions of Diocletian, of Galerius. He saw the end of that in 311. He saw the Edict of Milan in 313. And then he saw this almost inexplicable reality that the emperor has claimed to become a Christian and is interested in helping us hammer out theology. How can any of that be bad? And if you're living through it, the reality is, I mean, even if you saw it as bad, how do you resist that? I mean, one of the ways that people resist it is, well, we're not going to baptize them, but I don't really know how. How is it that the church and the empire can they work together? I mean, because all along, a lot of the scholastic discussion that's been going on is, can theology and philosophy work together? I mean, remember Tertullian. What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? There's no interactions. Or you have someone like Justin Martyr, who was first a Platonist philosopher that became a Christian and is like, oh my gosh, what all the philosophers are looking for is Jesus. And so you get this argument back and forth, specifically between the Greek and the Latin fathers. That's what they're really focused on. Can theology, can the church actually use and be compatible with philosophy? Well, in the 4th century, in the early 300s, they had to face themselves with this new reality. Is the church compatible with the empire? Is Christianity capable of handling power? Because those who used to be at the end of the sword are now those most likely holding it. Because here's the reality. It's not that Christians in droves started joining the military. It's that people started becoming Christians in droves everywhere. Because guess what? What used to get you killed now can get you a pretty nice position. Because the emperor favors Christians, especially Orthodox ones, not those nasty Arians. So what we're going to do is we're going to watch a church all of a sudden have a great influx of people, not really interested in catechizing themselves, not really interested in baptism, except as a nice rite, I guess, to get you in. But the reality is we're going to go to church, we're going to become a part of the church, because if we want some status in this culture going forward, we're going to have to be a part of the church. And the church, who has spent all of this time building up these barriers of entry, all of a sudden is just inundated with people that want to be Christians because the emperor is a Christian. What does that do? Well, in short order, it really, really annoys people. People who are Christians, people who were faithful during times of difficulty, all of a sudden have to deal with reality that it's not, as Tertullian was saying, that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Now it seems that Constantine's approval is the seed of the church, and these people are joining Christianity not because it's hard, not because it's the way of the cross, but because it's advantageous, and because it can actually get you money. And in reality, it might even expand your business propositions. Who knows? Can do all sorts of things. And the church has been dealing with this ever since. And the reality is, everything not only was legal, but soon it started to become expected. Not only was Christianity allowed not to be persecuted, that's Edict of Toleration 311, Edict of Milan 313 made it legal. After the Council of Nicaea, it becomes normative to be a Christian in the Roman Empire. So before this, you're talking maybe 10% of the entire empire are Christians. And even amongst them, several of them, when they were going to be martyrs, lapsed, refused. So by their own count, we're talking single digits. And then all of a sudden, high double digits. And entire complexes of church buildings were being built on the public dime, being built in the place of temples. Now, this is really, really hard for people to deal with at the time as a bad thing. All of a sudden, we're allowed to own church buildings. Imagine this. Imagine we used to all meet in a little house somewhere, afraid for our lives, right? Some of us tortured, some of us, our scriptures had to be burnt, and all of these things. All of a sudden, emperor becomes a Christian, comes to town, and goes, "You see that temple to Apollo over there? Yeah, we're going to demolish that, and we're going to build you a church. For free, it's yours. You don't owe any taxes." Lord's blessings, and then he leaves. How many people would say, okay. I mean, what are you going to say? No, leave the temple to Apollo. We'll just suffer here in this tiny little house, and we'd rather be persecuted. Well, some people actually said that, but the vast majority of people didn't. And the interactions with the emperor continued on. And this really finds a lot of its definition at the Council of Nicaea, where Constantine is sitting and presiding. That doesn't mean he's in charge. It just means, what does it mean? He's not in charge of the decisions, but he's there as the sponsor. Just there. Somebody else is in charge. And what was being dealt with there primarily, amongst other things, was Arianism. And we discussed this last time. Arianism was a Christological definitional issue. Arius, and then especially Alexander from Alexandria, just the best name of all times, was the one defending this at the Council of Nicaea and presenting it. And he came not thinking that he was coming to a hostile audience. In fact, it wasn't a hostile audience. He comes there explaining that Christ is the highest of all created things, the firstborn of creation, these types of ways of speaking. And all of a sudden, people realize that that places Jesus on the creation side of the creator-creation divide and not on the creator side. And then all of a sudden, everyone gets upset and we have to define this. Now we have to really define. Now we have to pronounce it an anathema. You go to hell if you believe this. So that's set, right or wrong, that sets the stage for how theology is going to be dealt with going forward. The thing is they weren't brought together to solve that problem. They were just brought together. Let's bring the whole church together. Why? Because the same thing that the emperors have tried to do in establishing the ancient religions of Rome to bring peace to the entirety of the Roman Empire, Constantine was using Christianity to do. You cannot have a divided Christianity if it's going to be the backbone of peace throughout the empire. And so when he says, "Hey, I want to pay all of you guys to come here," it's not because he's wanting to go, "I'm going to control theology, I really want to control it and puppet strings." No, no, no. I don't honestly believe Constantine cared one whit what they did as long as they were all in agreement. Yeah. As long as no one dies, you guys just stay in there and stay quiet. That'd be great. You know, just play quietly amongst yourselves. I don't want, and so for him to preside over that, I don't see as naturally an issue on the front end. It's on the back end that we have problems. It's on the ramifications and the expectations. The outcome of the Council of Nicaea is that Arius was excommunicated and exiled. Okay. That's a little bit worrisome, but I mean, he was a heretic, so it's not like that's ever going to happen to somebody who's not a heretic. So I guess we can cheer it along when it's our enemies, right, in theology. The thing is that, believe it or not, the Council of Nicaea did not solve the problem of Arianism. It didn't convince people who were convinced on the other side. It just made them, in addition to wrong, Christologically, it made them enemies of the state now, which is really problematic. There are many who were sympathizers of Arian concepts. Does not put everyone automatically on the same page. That doesn't really surprise us, does it? I mean, if for instance, we live in such a different time period, it's so hard to find an equivalency of it. But let's imagine that a really popular politician pulls together all sorts of pastors from all over the United States and comes together to decide LGBT issues tomorrow. And then the solution that comes out of that, really popular these days to support this, but like for someone like me, them disagreeing with me, even if I'm in the minority, is not going to change my opinion. It's not going to be like, oh, well, I guess they ruled. I guess I'm wrong. No, that's not how theology works. What it does is it just kind of points out who's on which side and draws the lines. And so the Council of Nicaea doesn't have the power to do this either. All it does is it tells people where the official lines are, and that really starts becoming the new way to speak about it. There's an official theology, and then that necessitates the reality of unofficial theologies. And so we're not talking about orthodoxy yet, where there's just one right way to believe. That's what ortho and doxy means, one proper belief. Council of Nicaea also tried to settle on to certain practices. You know, when someone's excommunicated from one church, don't accept them into the other church. We got to have some working together. There has to be unity along these lines, obviously. After Nicaea, so that's a review of that. After Nicaea, Constantine is seen as the enforcer of Nicaea, which is not really what everyone was expecting to happen. Constantine really starts using it as the litmus test for peace in the kingdom, because that's what he was there for. He wasn't there to answer questions about Jesus. Let's be honest. The guy didn't even know of Jesus a decade before. The idea that he would fully grasp even the issue that's going on, I don't believe it. I honestly don't. The reality of what he wanted out of that was a unified theology that can bring solidity to the kingdom. And the reality is what he then uses it for is to enforce solidity in the kingdom. And so when something arises that threatens official theology, Constantine will not be your friend. You do not want to be against the emperor, which makes... Now, here's the thing. There's nothing in Nicaea that I disagree with. But the question isn't whether what was decided at Nicaea was right or wrong. The real question is, who gets to enforce that and with what force? Because what used to be powerless and persecuted is now powerful and wealthy. Right? So those, and this happened in a single lifespan. And so people are really wrestling with whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It's a good thing because theology has been rightly done. It really has. They did a great job there. There was only 5 dissenters of the 318 bishops when it came down to a lot of the specifics. That's amazing. Where do you find that unanimity anymore? But the reality is the effects of it. People started realizing Constantine wasn't there just to ensure that theology was unified. He wanted everyone to have a higher view of this religion too. And so just like any other emperor, when they want the ancient religions to play a solidifying role in the kingdom, one of the things he does is build temples, what we refer to as churches. We want to build churches at the most important of places. So when we build a temple, for instance, to Diana, there's a reason why that temple to Artemis, same goddess, is in Ephesus. There are certain things going on in Ephesus that necessitate a recognition of that, whether it was part of the story, the mythos of this, whatever the case may be. So where are you going to go build churches? Well, Constantinople, for one. I mean, let's be honest. Constantinople's getting the biggest churches. But what's important when you read the New Testament and the Old Testament? It's the Promised Land. We're going to go to Jerusalem. Turns out, Constantine's mother, Helena, believe it or not, Saint Helena, you know, same woman that the place where Napoleon was banished to is named after. Saint Helena, Christian lady, is sent by her son, the emperor, to Jerusalem. Go to the Holy Land. And she has experiences there with dreams and so forth that lead her to discovering all sorts of things. While there, she discovers that under this temple to Apollo, and also talking to the bishop in Jerusalem at the time, it was filled in and built over the original tomb of Jesus. And so she, having not only the authority of my son as the emperor, but also I have a huge pile of gold from the emperor to do whatever I want here, we will completely destroy the temple to Apollo. We will dig down and find that tomb. Which they did. And once they did, they found inside three crosses. I'm going to tell you how the rest of the story goes. Someone's almost dead. We got to figure out which cross, so we rub each cross on them until they come back to life, and the third one does it. That's Jesus' cross. Boom! Let's build a church on top of this place where something so grand has happened. Today, it is called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it's still there in Jerusalem. Well, that works. Let's go find where he was born. So we traipse on down to Bethlehem, talk to the local pastors there. Where is it that Jesus was born? Here's the cave where he was born. Great! Church of the Nativity. Still there to this day. These things were built there because it was understood that the significance of what happened in that specific locale is overwhelming. Now, notice what they didn't do is build a church on Mount Moriah, where the Temple of Solomon was, and today where a mosque stands. That was important to Jews and later on to Muslims, but to Christians, not so much. Notice that their focus is not to go back to the temple. Their focus is on Jesus. Nativity, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, several others along the way. Those are the most significant ones. And we also found, naturally, the nails of the cross. And so they were made part of, it depends on how you translate it, either like welded into the helmet of Constantine or actually melted down and became the helmet of Constantine, one of the nails. It's an interesting thing, but it starts to show how we're going to start dealing with the concept that certain things have magical properties to them based on their connection to something really, really important. Later on, we will call these relics. Right now, they're called something special. They're called, well, this is just wonderful. This is Christianity, isn't it? And people start making those faces. Thank you for Nicaea and everything. What? Well, at least he didn't get involved with the Bibles. So, it kind of depends on the history, and the history of relics is crazy the first 300 years as far as predictability. What we do know is that the bishop in Rome insisted that they had access to the bones of certain apostles and buried them in Rome, and under the original Basilica of St. Peter was supposedly his casket. Well, it's supposedly still there, even though that's been proven not to be Peter. But whatever. It's about what's important. It's not about what reality is. So it depends. So the idea of an inanimate object, like a nail or a cross or a tomb or a cave, has spiritual force and energy pouring out of it, as opposed to the bones of the apostles, which I will simply remind us has legitimacy in the scriptural narrative, that the bones of a prophet once brought somebody to life that happened to be buried on top of them. So, while that has it, the idea of inanimate objects is kind of a new thing in the 300s, which is why nobody's really been fighting for that. The Bishop of Jerusalem wasn't trying to build a church at the cave. It's kind of like, well, that's where it happened. I mean, it's kind of reality. We live in Jerusalem. Yeah, these are the streets that Jesus walked on. You know, sans the destruction of Jerusalem in 70, which, by the way, in the early 300s, they were still rebuilding the city from, because it was that destroyed. So, for inanimate objects, yes. For things that were dead, apostles and bones and things like that, that goes back before this a bit. But not like... It was more memorializing. It really wasn't like, if I get near St. Peter's corpse, I'm just going to do better. Or in life or whatever. That kind of theology was not there yet. That really does take off here with stuff like this. And, yeah, it goes absolutely insane in the medieval period and late Middle Ages especially, where you've just got nails of the Holy Cross everywhere in Europe. It's just all over the place. Yep. Right, and so here's the thing. So most Christians, if you ask them right now, if they've looked into it at all, you know, if you ask them where the tomb of Jesus is, they'll say the Garden Tomb. It wasn't the Garden Tomb. I can tell you that pretty much, almost assuredly. It looks so nice, and that's why it's so popular. But it's in the wrong place. It's in the wrong time period. It just doesn't work. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that probably truly is his tomb. There's no other really good candidate for it. And what's kind of interesting is they were early enough on in church history that cultural memory is still somewhat accurate. And it's not like we're talking about a huge swath of land. I mean, Jerusalem and all of this is kind of small, comparatively speaking. Right. So, best that we can put together, my opinion, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is indeed built on top of the tomb of Jesus, yes. And we do have Helen to thank for that. And that just adds to the complexity of this. What's that? Yeah, so were the crosses in there? Did this happen? Now, then we have to get into the story of hagiography, which is the writing of holy people. Once Helen becomes sainted, and we later on write about these things, is this history or is this just fantasy? It is history now. This is the real frustration, because when we talk about, is it history, who's writing it? And we really do have to analyze that, because the reality is if a president's press secretary, I'm not talking about our current one, I'm talking about any press secretary of any president, is writing that president's history, it's going to be slanted extremely and thoroughly. And the reality is that if somebody really wants a concept of the ultimate has finally come to pass, someone like Eusebius, that his eschatological vision is that we've reached the culmination of the church here with, you know, the Roman Empire, which for all intents and purposes, except for like India and Spain, we'll talk about that in a second, this is the whole world is now Christian. Isn't that what Jesus came to do? I joked a little while ago, at least Constantine didn't get involved with Bibles. So he commissions 50 Bibles. Now, commissioning 50 Bibles sounds like nothing when you can go to Amazon and just put 50 Bibles in your cart and get them delivered day after tomorrow. Nobody had ever done this ever. In fact, the entire concept of a codex, a book, rather than scrolls or loose leaf folded folios, the idea of gathering together a work the size of the Bible into, as it was discussed, a portable. Now, there's no way you're picking this sucker up. Portable means it's not like stuck in a library chained somewhere. It means three people are holding it type thing. I mean, these things are enormous. 50 Bibles are commissioned to be copied for the churches in Constantinople. You have to understand how marvelous that is. And how dangerous that is. It's great. It's awesome. It's frustrating. And it's crossing lines. And the reality is that were these Bibles done? Yes, they were. Later on, Eusebius was tasked to do even more Bibles. We actually have two of those. Those. Full, complete Bibles, yes. From this time period, we have them. They're called Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, based on where they were found. One was found in a monastery, St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Peninsula. The other one was found in, let's see, it's called Vaticanus. Where was it kept? Yeah, you got it. It was in the Vatican. These were full Greek Old and New Testaments written on vellum with three or four columns of... You got to understand how frustrating uncials are. It's all capitalization, no spaces, no punctuation. I know Greek. I can't read it for nothing. It's a very unique typesetting, very strange thing. Look them up there, called Codex Sinaiticus. You can actually see, this is the marvelous thing about living now. You can go and look at full digitized copies of every single page of the whole thing for free on CodexSinaiticus.com. It is. Yes. Oh, thank you. Yes. It's important to ask, isn't it? Because now we're talking in the 300s. Yes. As far as the New Testament, 27 books, all of them, right? Because at this point, the questions of canonicity have all, they're all in the wash hundreds of years before this now. So when we were talking about some of those canon issues, the vast majority of those were settled by the year 100, right? There was five books that had problems in some people's minds. Two of them, I'll bet you haven't read in years, 2nd and 3rd John. It takes you 5 seconds to read them, but people are just like, what value is this, you know, kind of thing. 2nd Peter and the book of Revelation and Jude. So those ones people had real trouble with, trying to go, is this, that, and whatnot. But by the time we get to about the year 200, nobody has any real questions at all anywhere. Even the Ethiopic church, who doesn't have any huge contract with the Roman Empire, has all of them, and they added just one more, which was the book of Enoch. But as far as for agreements on what is in the New Testament, all 27 have been fully recognized for over 100 years everywhere. That's just not even debate. We know that the church fathers, when they're quoting these things, you can actually reconstruct almost the entire New Testament from their quotes. Because they would just, that's kind of what they did. This is true because, and then they just quote the whole passage. And also, we thought this because that and that, and quote a whole passage. And so it's really cool. But so that's how we can kind of reconstruct that and know. So as far as the New Testament, all 27 books. As far as the Old Testament, all what we call 39 books, which to a Jewish Tanakh is not the same layout. They combine all the 12 minor prophets into one book and all this kind of stuff. It also has the Apocrypha in it. So these Bibles all have the Apocrypha in it, which is the 1st and 2nd Maccabees, Judith Tobit, all the other ones, right? The Bell and the Dragon, Susanna, you know, all of these little books that are from the intertestamental period that, again, are there. Does that mean they're Scripture? Nobody's ever made a statement about that. Now, as far as for Palestinian Jews, you know, we talked about all this. They didn't recognize that at all. So you won't find that in Hebrew. But the reason it's in these, it's all Greek. Because why? That's all from the Septuagint. And where is the Septuagint from? That's the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It's from Alexandria, which, as you know, is the center of all sorts of learning and everything else. And so if you're ever going to find a place that has more than any other place, it's going to be a place that has more access to everything. And that's just understood. There's a lot of people these days, if you pay attention to King James Onlyus, they will refer to the Alexandrian cult, for instance, which is a completely made-up concept that has nothing to do with history or knowledge or intelligence or any such thing. But it's a way to say that because they had things like the Apocrypha in their books or whatever, or because they used this certain typesetting or whatever, that it's wrong and shouldn't be listened to. And so when we have things like Codex Vaticanus, which is, you know, 600 years older than the Byzantine text types that the King James is based off of, they argue that older isn't better because it's from Alexandria and Alexandria's bad. Which is really an interesting way to put stuff. Yes, sir. Sure, sure. Yes, that was his first roundabout, yes.
Okay, so
that's how big Constantinople was becoming really fast. No, no, not yet. Which is why I say problematic, right? Anytime you get a large majority of things all in one place, all controlled by one authority, it makes me nervous. Especially when you're talking about something like Scripture. Now, here's the thing. No one at any point had all of the Scriptures everywhere in the world all under one roof. Ever. As far as for copies and so forth. So nobody could ever control the manuscript's history. That's really, really, really important. And it's something that the Quran, for instance, does not share with us, neither the Book of Mormon, right? So the Scriptures never, not even in their original writing, were all in one place, because they're written by different authors. So this multifocality is built into the pudding of Scripture. It's meant to be everywhere, rather than controlled by one place, like the Book of Mormon or the Quran or something like this, right? So it's actually a tremendous gift that we have. But anytime you get a really wealthy, influential, central power doing, we're going to make all the Bibles, that's where I'm just kind of like, eh, no. I mean, you can make them, knock yourself out, but no. And that's fine. And they have their own copying errors, just like anything else. They're all handwritten. There's no way to avoid that with handwritten things. So, but that makes some people a little queasy. A little bit, okay, so now he's in charge of Bible printing. That's a little weird. Well, at least he hasn't outlawed paganism. Okay, so the next year he abolishes paganism in the whole empire, which instantly makes everyone Christians or enemies of the state. What does that do? Diluting. Again, dilute, 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 dilute. Well, at least he's not in charge of spreading missionary efforts around the world. So the missionaries to India and Spain happened during his reign as well, and the expansion of the church to these places. A lot of it made possible, not directly done, but made possible by Constantine. Everything just pushes the limits of the boundaries of comfort for so many people with regards to the empire is just right here every time we're doing anything. And it's nice that he wants to pay for all our Bibles. It's nice that he wants to build all of our churches. It's nice, but can't you be our enemy a little bit? I mean, just something somewhere becomes a little problematic. Because what happens if he all of a sudden does something unexpected? How are we going to be able to stand up to him? I mean, yeah, he gifted us all these things and we're in the middle of all these things with him, but you know, who's going to say no to him? So when Arius comes to Constantine and writes him a letter and says, you know what, I recant everything. Can you restore me to the church? Constantine's like, yeah. Sure, you're okay, sure. The last thing I want is disunity in my empire. Absolutely. Welcome in. Oh, you live in Alexandria? I'm going to go ahead and send a letter to Athanasius, who is the current bishop in Alexandria, after Alexander of Alexandria was removed from Alexandria. My favorite sentence. And Athanasius is now there, and because, you know, he's in line with Nicaea, and, you know, a Christian guy. By the way, a very young guy. He actually broke some of the rules of canon law to become a bishop. He was 28 when he was elected there by the people of Alexandria, but they wanted him there because he was just unbending on everything all the time, didn't matter what the force was. And so they needed that in a place where Arianism was really, really popular, and Athanasius is just like, no, the heck with all that. Athanasius is one of my favorite guys in church history. He's described as a little black dwarf, which is just hysterical. It was a very loving term, to be perfectly honest. He was just known as this, like, way outshone his stature in person. Nobody could stand up to him because he had every single argument that there was. Alexandria, one of the most trained people that there was. And so when it came down to it, when Arius, who had been the source of all this trouble, was told by the emperor that he could rejoin the church, and then he comes with a letter from Constantine, Athanasius just goes, no. There. So, no, we're not going to do that. Athanasius of Alexandria, I'm not going to recognize a restoration to the church. And so the Arians in Alexandria take the opportunity to complain to the emperor of an enormous amount of accusations against Athanasius. Everything from having this, like, hand he does witchcraft with from an old, you know, sorcerer somewhere to, he doesn't actually hold to this. He does these things. Misuse of authority, all sorts of things. So in order to solve it, Constantine orders a synod, which is a small council in the city of Tyre. Because here's the thing, he had already invited a whole bunch of bishops to Jerusalem to commemorate the building of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And he says, well, while you're coming to town, we should go ahead and have a tribunal against Athanasius in Tyre. We don't really want to mess up Jerusalem with this, so let's meet up by the sea, and we're going to solve this small little theological controversy here. I'll side with the Arians. Meanwhile, we'll put Athanasius on trial and ensure that this is going to work out well. Everything is going to be fine. Do you see it unraveling? I certainly do. The problems that come from this is the reality that now we were all coming in the emperor's good favor on his dime to Jerusalem to honor a church built on top of the tomb of Christ. This is a great thing. And then he comes over here and asks our opinion with regards to this, but he's sitting on the wrong side. Because what's he concerned about? Unity in the church. The only thing standing between him and unity of the church is this stupid Athanasius. So just come here, do what you know needs to be done, and then we'll go to the tomb of Jesus. Isn't that a nice Saturday? Not only as I pay for it, I'm going to oversee it just to ensure that this is going to work out well, okay? The result of that synod, I know it's probably not surprising, is that Athanasius is removed from his bishopric by the emperor and sent into exile. Not because we disagree with his theology, necessarily, but because one of the challenges that stood up was, he wasn't going to send the annual allotment of corn to Constantinople from Egypt. That's what the Arians brought up, and that's the only thing that got to stick. And so Constantine was like, wait a second, so you're going to evade taxes? Exile. He removes them from the bishopric. So the outnumbered Arians in the local synod was enough to sway it. The reality is that a synod is local and regional, which means you can kind of pick who attends. And so there was a consensus that all of the theological stuff did not stick, but this one challenge of tax evasion, Constantine says, that's not even an issue of theology, that's an issue with me directly, he's in exile. So we don't even have to solve the other stuff. He Al Caponed it, yes. We can't get him on this stuff, so we'll get him on taxes. Exactly. All he wants is unanimity in the empire. Christianity makes for good unanimity until you bring unbelievers into it. And here's the real issue, and until you bring that kind of power into it. Now, was that a shrewd thing for an emperor to do? Yep. Constantine is shrewd like nobody else. Is that a Christian thing that just happened? This is what people start reacting to. Is like, okay, hang on a second. All right, so Council Nicaea, good. All right. It's a little weird that the emperor was there, but all right, well, that's fine. You know, he fed us every day and paid for all our ways. Well, that's fine. But a local synod where you get to select who comes here, and then if you don't win your theological argument, getting a person on tax evasion, removing one of our bishops, and somebody as loved as Athanasius, and then sending him to France. Yeah. Yeah, and this is where Constantine is like, well, I'm not saying I'm endorsing Arianism, but in this case, they were right. People's reaction to these things as a cloud of doom that is starting to head over the church is starting to realize, okay, the question isn't even, is this good or bad? The ball is rolling down the hill. There's no way to stop it. We have not just set precedents. We've leapt off a cliff, and there's no going back to the top of the cliff where the empire is the enemy of the church. And we knew where the lines were. Now there are no lines. It's a cloudy fog that we're trying to nail jello onto a wall that doesn't exist. And it's very, very upending for some people. And some people just do not know how to deal with it. And I will tell you honestly, if I was living at that time, I don't know how to deal with this. This is complicated stuff. The reality is some of it's so good. And Eusebius is writing about some of these things. We're looking at churches that look like this. Nothing like that existed outside of the pagan temples, which were just tremendous. Right? If you look at, for instance, you go to Ephesus and you see the old pillars of the Temple of Diana there. They're so enormous in their footprint that the temple itself is unimaginably huge. The footprint of one of those columns is larger than the house that we know to have housed the church in Ephesus next door to it. Just the footprints of one of the columns. Imagine trying to deal with this theology of that church now inhabits buildings like that. Who's our enemy? Anyone who desires to live a godly life will suffer, is a verse in Scripture. And people don't know what to do with that. People don't know what to do with the identity of what it means to be a Christian, because not only are we not suffering, which has been the normative experience for Christians for centuries, but now we're sitting next to people who are only Christians because it makes them more money. Now we have to understand being a bishop in a church means that you are wealthy now. And you're living in one of the largest houses in town. How are you supposed to be a rich Christian? Nobody's ever experienced that before. How are you supposed to follow the Messiah who did not have a place to lay his head when you have 50 servants that know how to lay their heads down on their own pillows? And you see these places where it says it's easier for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle, a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Whatever, you know what I'm saying. It's very difficult to be saved as a rich man. And the difficulty of this really sits heavy on people's minds. They are frustrated about it, and with good reason.
But you know, the thinking of this going on now, too, is also quite different in that they're more theological, philosophical, pragmatic, I guess, than this is troubling. But even if we're
yeah. Right. I mean, even if he banishes us, I mean, he's not going to live forever. Right? Anyone who's exiled from that emperor, when the next emperor comes along, usually gets released. Okay. We should be fine with that, right? I mean, that's what happened with Athanasius, because Constantine dies in 337. And so Athanasius, I think he goes into exile in 331. And so, what is that, 6 years? All right. Fine. You know, and then he comes back and he starts writing like some of the best books in all of the imperial church's history. That's remarkable stuff. Great, awesome stuff. But at least nobody's dying. In fact, not only are Christians not dying, Constantine puts an end to the games themselves. The gladiatorial games. He puts an end to like all old Rome. And this is something that it's so hard because when Christians are trying to swallow all of these things happening, they're just like, look at all the good cultural stuff that's happening because of Christianity. But then look at all the bad cultural stuff that's happening inside of Christianity. And then we know this because we've grown up in a soup, right? At times, it's very hard to draw the line between Christianity and the culture. Are Christians to be making culture? Are Christians to be taking part in it, imitating it, whatever? You know, are we supposed to have, like, I don't know, Pokemon Go, when it's really popular, someone was supposed to bring that into the church and, like, sanctify it somehow and turn it into something that makes people Christians? That doesn't work, by the way. Are we trying to create our own culture, separate and parallel from the rest of it? Are we trying to write our own books and make our own movies? Or do we just partake in the culture and don't question it, don't interact with it, or we just criticize it all the time? Or do we just separate it from it altogether? There's a lot of Christians in the Roman Empire in the early 300s that just go, too much for me, I'm out. And a tiny little habit in Egypt to go and live out in the desert and experience God in the heat of the day while you are hallucinating becomes a popular practice. Go live in the desert. The desert fathers, the desert mothers, women outnumbered the men sometimes 2-1 with a lot of these practices of just going out. There is one point in a single section of the desert in Egypt that at one point was argued to have 20,000 women and 10,000 men living in the different caves and rock outcroppings and various places on their own, just being completely alone, each of them. It wasn't like as a group. That comes later. The whole point was to get away from all things society, everything, and to just meditate. If the culture will not make us suffer, we will suffer. So there were people that saw it their responsibility to provide them bread every once in a while, and they would have this great wisdom or whatever, and so you come, you give them a loaf of bread, and they teach you something about the spiritual forces in the world. So, say it again, sorry.
Isn't the removal into the desert actually a way of removing oneself from the suffering that you've been seeing all around? And it's going pure meditation.
Yes. Yes. But the better that you suffer out there, the better your meditation.
Okay.
Because the Christian life should be one that suffers. The one who suffers is closer to the Lord. And since culture and society isn't suffering, it's just decadent and joyful, and so is money and everything else. Next week, what we're going to be looking at is not only Athanasius' return, but also a very, very important and influential figure in this is one of the earliest desert fathers, St. Anthony. We're going to be looking at him, his story, and how much this affects going forward. Because the reality is, whether you like monasticism or not, man, does that pave the way for the next 1,300 years. Of all theology, thought, scripture, meditation, writing, copying of scriptures, everything. So important that actually by the time you get to the 1500s, the only person that actually has access to something like this is an Augustinian monk, monastic, named Martin Luther. Right? So all along the way, we have monasticism becomes a massive force in the church. Not like massive in the fact that it's like percentage-wise an enormous amount of people, but the force in what it accomplishes is really incredible. And so we do need to spend some time with people like Anthony and people, for instance, like Benedict. The Benedictine monks becomes really, really important after the thing. So when you're talking about just one of the reactions of people going out and living in the desert by themselves. This is called, if you want terms for it, anchoritic monasticism. Anchoritic, like an anchor. And this is largely one person living by themselves in a cave or something like that. And every once in a while, their disciples will come to them and learn from them and give them some food and stuff. And then leave them alone. There's some of the disciples that try to emulate them in like a cave nearby. And, you know, and, oh, you're only allowed to do that if we only meet like once every like few months or something like this. It's an interesting reaction to this, and it really is the beginning points of something that becomes so influential. It doesn't become influential as individuals sitting out there, it becomes influential when it becomes people joining together to go separate from society and making a completely different society. What we refer to as, you know, later on monasteries and stuff like this, in the earlier part is just people doing this together. That's called cenobitic monasticism, C-E-N-O-B-I-T-I-C. Cenobitic monasticism. That's people living together trying to accomplish these things. That stuff will come up a lot next week. We're going to be talking a lot about monasticism because the reality is that that reaction to the official theology is you guys can write, you know, from the Council of Nicaea, the canons and the creeds and all this kind of stuff, but since there are no confessors, since there are no persecutions and no martyrdoms to go to, I'm going to go suffer my own almost martyrdom. And that gives a certain spiritual authority to people. Just like the confessors who were even in attendance at at the Council of Nicaea, who bore marks and burns of their own persecution, had a certain spiritual aura, if you will. Same thing goes to the early monastics. Even if it's self-inflicted. Now, this is the thing. That's a really slippery slope when it comes to self-inflicted injury leading to higher spiritual involvement. You cross the line into paganism really quick. And the reality is that Christians had a real hard time with this. You do have mentions in Scripture of people becoming eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven. And certain people saw this as one of the ways to suffer for the kingdom. This type of stuff, while it sounds so kind of distant from us, the reality is that people were so desperate for identity as a Christian that there really was no length that people would not go to at this time period because they just didn't know how to handle this kind of stuff. And not that they didn't know how to handle it. I don't want to make that sound as if I'm looking down on them. I really am not. They're trying to define where the lines of Christianity are. And they're not seeing their contemporary betters or bishops or anything like this living in wealthy palaces as authorities on this anymore. And so while the official theology is right, it's coming from a very unhealthy source. What happens when the emperor dies and one of his sons becomes emperor? And guess what? He's an Arian. Now what? Because now we have this precedent that the emperor has the right to sit at our councils and make decisions and influence things. What do we do with that? You were going to say something, sorry.
In religion, they have these same kind of things where they have to go to the mountain and talk to. Is that a reflection of this movement? Or is this movement kind of a reflection of that movement?
Yes, and. So, monasticism and such things has been a very, very old thing. This is the first time where it became largely involved in Christianity. You see it with people like John the Baptist, even in the New Testament. You see it with the Essene community in the intertestamental period, those who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they were living in the mountains outside in what we refer to as the wilderness in the Old Testament. You see David exemplifying this. You see Elijah exemplifying this. You see Moses exemplifying this. Jesus going to the wilderness. You see all of these things. I know it's not the same, but the reality is you get someone like John the Baptist, and what the heck do we do with this dude? He's defined by what he wears and the crazy stuff he eats and the fact that he lives in the wilderness. So that's the claim. I'm sent here by God. What do I do? Yeah, what do you say? And I mean, let's be honest. You look at the Nazarite vow. You're not far off of some of the monastic vows, which means you actually start having definitions of vows starting to come out that are connected to Scripture in places that really have no business in the church, but they're pulled from the Old Testament. Oh, and from paganism. By the way, the concept of bishops now being called priests, that starts coming into the church, right? Same time period. One of the reasons is, well, what do you have? The basic understanding of how people interact with God is we go through our priest. You don't go and offer the sacrifices to the pagan deities direct. You just bring it, the priest takes care of it. That worldview, when you bring a whole bunch of unbelievers into the church and call everyone Christian in all of Roman Empire, guess what? It's just going to happen. People are going to start seeing the bishop as priest. It's one of the reasons why I sit there when we have communion rather than handing you communion. I'm not a priest. Any more than any other Christian is a priest. This is one of the things that took another 1,200 years to finally come to the Protestant Reformation in the Western Church, where we finally had to say, okay, stop the priest talk. We're all priests. There's not a priesthood inside the church that is like this laity-clergy separation that just, it's foreign to the New Testament. There's no such thing as priests like that in the New Testament church. We see pastors and elders. We see deacons. What else do we see? Nothing. And so, but the reality is that doesn't come from the New Testament. It wasn't trying to come from the New Testament. It was a parallelism even to the Old Testament, but it was also influenced by paganism. We need priests. And so stuff like that starts coming into the church and changing things and morphing the ways we do things, which starts looking at things like communion as something different, and priests as carrying out something more significant than teaching and the ministry of the word and the ministry of encouragement of good works. They're actually doing something highly spiritual, if not mystical. And so when you start seeing the influx of things like this, the reality is you can no longer separate the culture and the church. It just doesn't work anymore. The church is not separate from the culture. The church is now built into it. And so that means when there's wars in the culture, the wars come into the church. And while it is our responsibility to hold it off as much as we can and to focus on Christ, no matter how much we want our wars to come into our pews, it is my understanding that it is one of the chief responsibilities of the leadership of the church to not let that do such a thing and run rampant. Can you imagine if all we do is sit in here and argue about politics? I mean, even if we lived in the Roman Empire, we argue about Constantine. No, we're supposed to be focused on Christ. What are we doing here? Why are we talking about Constantine and, oh my gosh, which of his sons is going to take over once he dies here? He's in his 35th year of his reign. How are we going to handle it if Crispus gets in control, or what if Constantine II gets in control? I've heard he's got weird things. This one was trained by a good theologian that was of the official theology. This one was influenced by an Arian. I mean, you think our politics are bad? Holy cow. I cannot even imagine living at this time. Because whoever gets on the throne, guess what? They have ultimate power. And that happens. The church is wrestling with all of these things. And with Constantine, you get a poor church turned wealthy, a church that is persecuted, that now defines itself by pomp and glorious buildings, and dead congregations. All of a sudden, we get a whole bunch of unbelievers in the church, and those who were even just believers but not really that concerned about all these things get influenced by all of this. All of a sudden, wealth really becomes the main motivating factor to become a Christian. What do you do? This really defines how the church thinks of itself. And if there's anything that's most helpful, rather than coming to someone like Eusebius of Caesarea, who most of the history that we get from this time period comes from him, at least before 300. We have a lot of historians that write of the 300s. But someone like him, even though he's a fan of Constantine, he's not like on Constantine's dime. He spends his whole life in Caesarea, down in Palestine. Even somebody who is a fan of Constantine like he is and sees this current situation, this current zeitgeist going on in the church as like the culmination of all these things, it helps us to understand how the church was thinking of itself, to just read him, to just read his own histories and to see this like progressivist, accomplished eschatology. We are here. This is how the world will be. Imagine, Christianity has ended civil wars in the Roman Empire. In the ultimate sense, that's how it will be. And as many people as were trying to leave the church for things like monasticism to just escape this because they saw this as adulterous, there were people in the church that were offering sacrifices to images of Constantine. You've got both extremes trying to live in the church. Far from bringing unity to the empire, we just brought the empire into the church. And the reality is that it brings in all the problems of the empire, all the disunity of the empire, straight into it as well. And as much as it attempted to keep everything together, it really wasn't capable of doing so for more than 100 years. The Roman Empire splits east and west, the Latin side and the Greek side. And guess what that does to the church? It splits it east and west. The Eastern Church is what we know today as the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Western Church is the Roman Catholic Church, which then, becoming so full of its own pomp and wealth and influence and swords and armies and crusades and everything else, finally had to have a reformation for Christians to actually break off from it and say, this is not what the church was supposed to be. The reality is that the separation inside the church that officially took place in 1054, which is, 700 years into the future, had all of its underpinnings here. In the 4th century, at the beginning of the 5th century, once the Roman Empire fell, we call it the Roman Empire fall. Guess what? The people living in the East, I don't know what you're talking about. It didn't fall. The West just left. They fell. We're good. We're called the Byzantine Empire. And they lived on for years and years and years and years up into the 1800s. The Byzantine Empire continued on. And the reality is that the churches that were there had to deal with things within the next couple hundred years, things like the Islamic invasions and all sorts of pressures, all sorts of things. Now, they had their own troubles in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So next week we're going to be talking about monasticism, Athanasius, St. Anthony, all these. The next one we're going to be introducing the Eastern Orthodox, right? We're going to be talking about the Eastern Church because this is important. Most people, when they're teaching in the West, Western Church history, they're just going to focus only on, let's figure out how it got to us. That's important, and we will eventually get to that. But we need to keep in mind that there's millions of Christians throughout history that care nothing for Rome. And Rome cares nothing for them. And the reality is that that's not how someone is becoming a Christian, as to whether or not they're linked with Rome, no matter what Rome says. And the concept of Rome being primacy and in charge of all this kind of stuff, that did not even exist here. Maybe it was in the minds of a couple of people who were bishops in Rome. Let's be honest, a lot of bishops were full of themselves in the 300s. The bishop in Constantinople, I assure you, was full of himself with this kind of stuff. The reality is, when you feel like you're the center of the world and in charge of it, it's not hard, one decision after another, to start arguing, you know what, I really am as great as everyone thinks I am. And this happens to the bishop in Rome because the reality is there are certain centers of the church that are seen as responsible for certain areas. In the West, that's Rome. There's not really any other major center of the church. Okay, I mean, you had an entire, the longest epistle in the New Testament is written to your church. Sorry, if there's nobody else that has any claim to it. Every other church, by the way, that's written to is either in Greece or in Asia Minor. Who cares about all of them? So it did the Thessalonica and Ephesus and Philadelphia, all these, who cares about all that stuff? Rome. Rome is good. In the East, we have, well, of course, Alexandria. I mean, you got every learned person there. You have Christian philosophical schools there. I mean, Alexandria is one of them. They're kind of responsible for a lot of Egypt. Jerusalem, of course that's going to be a center of the church. It's been the center of everything since all of history and all of time, even before Abraham. I mean, let's be honest, Jerusalem's going to be influential. Where did the church go from Jerusalem, even in the book of Acts? Antioch. It's where Christians were first called Christians. That's going to be influential. That becomes the center of the church. What also is going to become the center of the church? Constantinople. To this day, There's the Bishop of Constantinople, who is still there. I think he pastors a church of 20 people, but the reality is, the official stance is that the ones in the East saw themselves as equal in making these decisions. Even as patriarchs of the church, even though they had a layer above bishop, they saw themselves as patriarchs of the church. As history wears on, the Eastern Orthodox Church gains things like Moscow, and that start, now we actually lost Moscow, which most people in the West couldn't care less. That happened 5 years ago. Nobody, first time it's happened in centuries. It's gone. It's separated from the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church. So there's the Greek Orthodox Church, and you start to see, as you go through history, different Orthodox churches define themselves by their nationality. Now what? Oh, you have little Romans everywhere. But in the Eastern Orthodox Church, they officially see themselves as equals. We'll cross this. Rome doesn't. Rome is Rome. And when we get into the medieval church, we're going to start to see that the effects of what's happening here in the 300s, you would think that the one that saw themselves as most important is Constantinople. But it's not. It's Rome. And one of the realities is because the head of all government went to Constantinople, and in Rome, in addition to being so primary in the awareness of Christians, the center of where Peter and Paul actually did go, there's a power vacuum, a big one. When all the aristocrats left, when all of the government left, when the emperor is no longer there, but we still have one of the oldest cities in the world with some of the greatest designs, aqueducts, everything. What do we do with all of this? And you start to find out that the influence of the Bishop of Rome starts to grow bit by bit by bit by bit in the absence of the empire. And after the fall of Rome in the early 400s, by the time we get to the year 600, we start to have the Bishop of Rome claiming themselves as in charge of the church worldwide and trying to exact that influence everywhere. And that will continue on. And one of the crazy things, I'll tell you this short little story before we get to closing out tonight. There's a document that was called the Donation of Constantine. Sounds interesting, right? Interesting document. Claims that Constantine offered the crown to the Bishop of Rome for the entire empire. Basically donated the empire to the church. And so it's the church's donation. Problem with it is, it was used to establish all sorts of things from the years about 700 onwards for about 500, 600, 700 years of influence so that Rome could build itself up as to what it was. The entire empire belongs to us. Everything. Remember, Constantine, that includes Constantinople, that includes Jerusalem, which gives us the right to do things like crusades and liberate people of their land. And all of these things, we are able to do all these things. It is ours to do so because the emperor donated all of this to us, to the Bishop of Rome. It was a forgery. It's a forgery from the 700s. And here's the thing. That wasn't even discovered until the 1500s. It was used for 600, 700 years to influence the decisions of Rome to make itself in charge of the world. And here's the thing. Go look it up in the Catholic Encyclopedia. They also recognize it as a forgery today. Yes, they do. Fully admit, everybody knows it is now. Yes, almost certainly we know who. Because now we have lexicographical, we know how, what kind of words they were using didn't exist before this time. Like it was really an interesting way as to how it was proven to be a forgery, complete and utter. The reality, though, of what that reveals, it's kind of like Eusebius, right? I'm not looking to him for lots of accurate information. I'm looking to see how the church thinks of itself. And so what is the church in the West thinking of itself in the 700s? We're in charge of the world. How do we prove it? Okay? Because that shows us the attitude. What do we need to do? What do we look? If you're in the year 740 and you're going, I got an idea. What was a transition point in the history of the world that anyone would believe that we're in charge of the world? Constantine. We're going to go back. We're going to have this. He donated everything, donated the imperial crown to the Bishop of Rome. We've actually been in charge of this all along. It reveals one of the main influential attitudes of the church in the 700s that's in the West. And here's the thing. If you know your history timeline, when you come to the year 800, one of the most important moments in church history happens. That is the crowning of Charlemagne by the Pope. The Pope crowns the Holy Roman Emperor. We're in charge. We give you some delegated authority. That changes politics in the West forever. And the reign of Charlemagne, after that, all of this soup is going on. And what we're working through here is the underpinnings of this. And so when you say, is this a good thing that happened? Is this a bad thing that happened? It's the reality of what happened. The effects of it are complicated. The reality is, at the end of the day, is it better that we're persecuted? Is it better that we're compromised? I don't know. It's better that we walk with Christ wherever he puts us. And this is the difficulty of the church trying to define itself and trying to decide how to even discuss these things. It affects everything from eschatology to soteriology. Eschatology, doctrine of last things and the end of the world. Soteriology, doctrine of salvation. What is salvation about? Is it really even interested in this life? And the reality is, a lot of the history of focusing on salvation has just to do with the life to come and nothing to do with this life here, finds a lot of its roots here in the 300s. Here with this idea that I can be wealthy here because salvation is just about after my death. And so it doesn't really change anything or introduce anything, or the eschatological hope is about my life after death. It's really not about the importance of Eucharist or baptism or any of these things. Any questions? That's a lot of stuff. Now, the reality is, you get all sorts of things, not even stuff like the donation of Constantine. If you want to look, the whole history of the popes, for instance, that was written around the same time, the Liber Pontificus, is the history of the bishops of Rome. The first 500 years of which is just mainly fabrications as far as for their influence in the world. Now, these may well have been the bishops that were in Rome at the time. Some of them are referred to. Some of them are mixed up. But as far as for their influence, nobody cares because it's just one of the bishops amongst hundreds. But the reality is that if you look at how, like, for instance, the Western Church interprets its own history, these were the ones that were in charge of everything. They could just go out and command people. And the reality is that that's just not history. That's not the way it was. In Rome? Yeah. So that happened a couple times in history. Now, if you ask Rome, never. That never happened. We had a pope and an anti-pope. I mean, they're just not real popes. But at the time, there was two popes. In fact, during the Avignon papacy, there was three. So that happens a couple of times. That's not until later. That's not until considerably later. So you have a lot of stuff that's just not known about a lot of these popes. The first major actual pope is Gregory the Great. He serves from, oh my goodness, let me pull this out of my memory bags, 590 to 604, I think it is, or 606. So the Gregorian chants, right? The Gregorian calendar, this dude, okay, he's in charge of everything, right? So he's the first one who'll actually be referred to as pope. That's the year about 600. So that kind of shows you where they're at. And when the East falls to the Islamics in 40 years, guess what? That claim to papacy, really, who's going to disagree now? Nobody. Nobody's here to do so. In fact, one of the crazy things, I'll just tell you this quick story, happened in my life. I had a teacher from Tanzania, right? Eastern church guy. Awesome guy. One of my favorite theologians. He and I don't agree on everything. I don't care. But awesome guy, really cool stuff. We were quoting the Nicene Creed, and guess what came up? One little phrase of difference. That the the Spirit proceeds from the Father, and in the West we say, and the Son. And when we were quoting it, guess what? He doesn't quote and the Son. And it just, all of a sudden, a history lesson came rushing back. Oh, crap. We put that in the creed without asking the Eastern Church. And when they were coming together for communion one year, all of a sudden, all the bishops and the monks from the Western Church said, and the Son. And the monks and everyone from the Eastern Church said, what? Don't you remember when we all gathered together? What authority did you change that on? And what was the answer? Ours. It's known as the Filioque Clause. And it's just a fancy term for we added some words. And when you add words to a creed that we had all gathered together to meet, and the Eastern Church says, and now how, what, what? And the Western Church says, our authority. That's how we changed it on. What are you going to do? Yeek. That's what the medieval church starts to look like. And so it's how we get from persecuted to we have buildings, everything's legal, what do? Fall of Rome. And that's how we end up getting to the medieval and the late Middle Ages and all of this controversy of what to do and how to do it. And who's in charge of what? Because the reality is, you can see now, it's not really far of a leap to say, if there's a theological controversy, who do we ask? Just ask the bishop in Rome. I mean, he's going to point us with a sword anyway, if we're wrong. So how about we just check with him first? Oh, he says this, and everyone else is anathema? Okay, great. And so you say, well, are councils over the pope? Or do popes rule? Who's in charge of what? And then we have the Age of Reason, the Renaissance, and all this kind of stuff comes in. Yeah, all sorts of stuff gets canceled. So it's going to be interesting and quite the trip. And we're going to have to talk about the Western and the Eastern Church as separate as early as the 300s, because not only were they different cultures, there were different sides of the Roman Empire. They spoke different languages. One was speaking Latin, one was speaking Greek. And it's why, again, it's why the Roman Church today still has Latin. It's because they're keeping Rome alive. It's on life support for 1500 years. And so that's why when you're asking, oh, I studied Latin. Which Latin? Ecclesiastical Latin or classical Latin, which is dead? The only place Latin lives, the Catholic Church. Right? That's why. They're keeping Rome alive. That's why their buildings look like basilicas and their later buildings look like Gothic architecture, because the Franks came in to Rome and Gothic just means the disgusting way that Franks build buildings. Literally, it was a dismissive term. Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts here at the end? Let's pray for God's grace. Father, we thank you for today. We are humbled to study history. It is a challenge to us. It is a challenge to even work through some of these things. They are complicated and deep, but the reality is these are our brothers and sisters struggling through things in a time different than ours. They would look at our time and call us lazy and wealthy, and some people would see us as enemies. We pray we don't have that same perspective, that we see them as those whose shoulders we stand on, and we learn from what wisdom their struggles brought out. We pray that we may also live lives of wisdom and example to those who come after us, even though our stories will not likely be read in a church somewhere thousands of years from now, we know that you read our story. And we're grateful for that. We thank you for your grace. In your Son's name, amen.